хакеры взломали переписку истеблишмента Демпартии.
За этой кибератакой стоит именно Россия.
Русские хакеры оставили след.
Предположительно, может быть связано с российскими спецслужбами.
Россия якобы имеет отношение к взлому электронной почты.
Fabricated news stories, fake NGOs, cutouts, front groups, useful idiots, stage demonstrations and manufactured scandals. Welcome to the wonderful world of aktivne mereприятия, or active measures. From the infamous Lisa scandal in Germany to the hack of the DNC's email service in the United States, and hundreds of other less publicized incidents, this old Soviet tactic of using disinformation, distortion, deception, and deceit to divide, confuse, and paralyze the West is having something of a revival. But how effective are these active measures anyway? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to the podcast, Don.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning and good afternoon here. So Russia's use of so-called active measures was back in the news recently with the DNC hack and the subsequent leak of embarrassing emails. And in many ways, this kind of thing seems to be becoming a staple of Kremlin policy. Mark, I know you're pretty skeptical about the effectiveness of active measures from the conversations we've had both on and offline. But at the same time, they seem to have us all pretty rattled. How important is this tactic to Russian tradecraft? And what's the appropriate level of concern here?
Two interesting questions. If one addresses, first of all, the point about how important this is to Russian tradecraft, although obviously active measures is not unique to Russians, but nonetheless, it really is still pretty central. And in this respect, it's something that to an extent we saw in Tsarist times. We then very, very much saw as a feature of the Soviet era. And we now see it as part of the Russian model. And it's interesting because in some ways I would suggest that the world has moved on. But in many ways, I think the thing is that the Russians haven't. They've moved on tactically in terms of learning new ways of active measures. But philosophically, realizing that, in fact, the world is now far, far too complex to be sort of maneuvered in this way, I think that they haven't picked up on. And this feeds into your second question about the appropriate level of concern. I mean, as you say, I'm much, much more skeptical about the actual outcomes. I think there's a distinct lack of data suggesting that this really does have an impact. And to an extent, we are both, on the one hand, I think sort of overexcited by this. And obviously, there is also a huge cottage industry in addressing it. But at the same time, I think the Russians give us an alibi. The Russians sometimes do give us an alibi for not addressing the questions of the deficits of legitimacy and political numeracy, shall we say, among our own populations. It is so much easier to blame it on Russian machinations rather than our own failures to communicate and connect to audiences.
Although those two things aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, as you quite aptly put it at the Warsaw Security Forum last year, Putin basically holds a mirror up to our shortcomings and our failures and amplifies them. So
he will exploit to the fullest. But the point is, we give them the purchase points. And then instead, sometimes, in my view, of addressing the purchase points, the weaknesses in the West that actually give Putin his opportunities, we point the finger at the Russians and say how terrible. Of course it's terrible, but seriously, what else can we expect? As far as the Russians are concerned, as far as the Kremlin is concerned, in a way, they are already at war, an ideological, cultural war, not a shooting war. But nonetheless, at war, and therefore, of course, they're going to take fullest opportunity of these weaknesses. Now, that's not in any way to explain away or justify or legitimize that, but simply to say we have to realize that we give him those initial purchase points. Mm.
Don, your thoughts on this? I mean, how important is this to Russian tradecraft, and what do you think? Would you agree with Marx?
Brian, I guess I would say I don't see it as a question of Russian tradecraft. I see it as part of a much more broad Russian effort to expand, I was going to say militantly, its influence abroad. So for me, The information part of it is part of a series of weapons and arsenal, the Russian Orthodox Church, money, a lot of other things that we see every day. And I think the Russians pick a strategy, a target, whether it's Poland or London or Washington, and pick a series of weapons that they calculate, not always correctly, is likely to advance their interests. Mm-hmm. And that's why looking at Poland versus Serbia versus Georgia versus London is, I think, those are not exactly always the same thing. One thing this reminds me of, this debate, is the debate about the missile gap in the 1980s, where one side said the Russians could take out the whole world and have these secret, powerful weapons. And the other side said, well, they're not real. They're sort of a paper tiger. And I think that the reality is in between. It's very much a threat, in my view. But if it's a weapon, if it's an information weapon, which I think it is, all weapons have their purposes. And some purposes, a certain weapon is not particularly adapted for. And I think that's why when you look at information warfare, you've got to look at the interaction, as Mark said, with the West, but more specifically, what particular target in the West? Mm-hmm. I think no one listens to RT in Washington, guys, and takes it seriously. But I've seen the Estonian listenership numbers, for example, and 25% of the population in Estonia, the Russian part, Russian-speaking part, prefers Russian news from Moscow. And this, I think, is understandably something that the people there, the government there, should be aware of and be concerned about.
Now, when we talk about, okay, actually take a step back here, just for people that may not be familiar with this term, active measures, because when we're talking about active measures, it's a direct translation from the Russian, as I noted in the intro, but it's about more than information policy. It's about more than disinformation. I mean, you both kind of are experts on the intelligence side of things. How would you define active measures? I mean, where's the boundaries of what's an active measure and what's not? Don, if you are...
I try not to define it because, as you said, it could be everything. It could be the Olympics. It could be something else, from doping to spreading money around Washington to certain lobbyists, which happens too. So I think you're correctly taking a broader version of it and not limiting it just to the kind of manipulative George Smiley kind of stuff.
Right. Now
let me give us a sense of a possible definition. In some ways, we can almost think of it as a trinity. Warfare, when it comes down to it, is the use of coercion and armed force to bring about some kind of political impact. Diplomacy and politics are, shall I say, the overt means of achieving a particular political end. Active measures is what fits in between. Active measures is covert political operations to bring about particular political means that in some ways are defined simply by the fact that they don't fit into the others. They're less than war, but nor are they the open and overt branches of politics, though clearly diplomacy sometimes shades into it. But in some ways, this is why I think it's so difficult to come up with a really solid definition of active measures, because it is precisely, it's everything else that isn't in the two more clearly recognized realms of activity.
And I would add two other elements to that too. A lot of it's based on deception and falsification, and it's also aims to divide and confuse basically your opponent. Now, Don, we were chatting kind of offline on email yesterday, and you noted that the research on the effectiveness of active measures is only really now just getting started. Which actually, to me, that's pretty amazing since how long these things have been around. We're going to talk in the second half about the Soviet era active measures and how they stack up against today's. But are there any preliminary conclusions out there from the research that has been out there? And what's your take?
As you say, and as we talked about, yes, it's very preliminary. Clearly, there's an impact. If there weren't an impact, Debbie Wasserman Schultz would still have a job. But to get a systematic sense of it is much more difficult, and is actually quite a research challenge. If you talk to people in Serbia, they will say, well, the Russian Orthodox Church is more important than actual information. People still want a Western lifestyle, that kind of thing. So I think if you look at, and not enough people I think have, the country, the target, and the tools chosen to advance Russian interests, that's probably the way to go. The SIPA report this week did a great job of recommending and making a lot of recommendations. But again, in order to get the right policy mix, you've got to know what is the impact of Russian broadcasting in Narva or in Belgrade or someplace else. And that's really where I think a lot of work needs to be done.
Yeah, and then I agree. The SIPA report, "Winning the Information War," by the Center for European Political and European Policy Analysis, authored by Edward Lucas and Peter Pomerantsev, two often guests, frequent guests in this podcast, is certainly worth a read for anybody out there interested in this topic. Another thing I wanted to get at is also, I mean, how much strategy is there here, or is it all tactics? Are they just throwing stuff out to see what sticks? Because, like, I'll see things about separatist republics in the Baltic states. I'll see a Facebook page out there, and it's obviously this is active measures. But is anybody taking this seriously? And you have to wonder, are they just throwing stuff out there to see what sticks? Is there a concerted strategy? Are they seeing what works? Mark, what do you see here?
In some ways, I think this is actually a metaphor for how Putinism works on the whole, which is actually precisely that it is much, much less strategic than is often thought. It's not this sort of grandmaster playing chess. It's simply that it is made clear that there is an overall objective, and therefore it is up to a whole variety of different agents and instruments to do things that they think will both please their master, but above all, actually further these ends. And the virtue of that is that, firstly, everything is deniable. You can just drop a particular initiative if it works, doesn't work, or begins to become politically problematic. Secondly, it's a way of trying to channel all the different, as it were, entrepreneurial zeals and enthusiasms and imaginations of a whole variety of different agencies and such like. But the downside is, firstly, that a lot of it is stupid. Secondly, that precisely there isn't this clear, sharp focus, which is, for example, which we saw in the Soviet era, which obviously we'll talk about in the second half. But also, I think that it means that, in a way, often the Kremlin, in the Kremlin's name, things that are actually counterproductive in the long term get done. Because I think, for me, this is one of the fascinating issues. And I mean, absolutely, one can point to various impacts and so forth. And I'm just, while I'm in passing, just pick up on and very much support the point that Don made about it's not just about propaganda. We see that because the whole point of propaganda is to be visible. But things like money are, in my account, far, far more powerful instruments. But the whole point is money is almost by definition a covert tool compared with RT or whatever. So you have all these things. Often in the short term, they seem to have an impact, but often in the longer term, I would say, are counterproductive. And in some ways, just as we're sitting here saying that we actually don't really yet have a really solid basis on which to be able to assess the instruments, the goals, and the outcomes. Well, my deep suspicion is that exactly the same could be said in the Kremlin. That people will come to them like cats bearing small dead birds, sure that you will want to have this presented to you, terribly proud. And sometimes the Kremlin will be delighted, and sometimes the Kremlin will be revolted, and sometimes the Kremlin will think, well, what the hell is all this about? But a lot of the sort of the stuff that doesn't work, I'm sure, never gets presented to the Kremlin in the first place. So I think the irony is that this is actually, as it were, almost a war that is being fought by individual infantrymen and infantry women in the trenches, and none of the generals really can see through the fog of war.
Uh-huh. Don, would you concur with that?
Yeah, I would say there's a relatively coherent attempt to see what sticks, but that's an emphasis on relatively. I very much agree with Mark that this is a reflection of Putinism, and so we constantly debate how much is Putin in control of the oligarchs or the Siloviki and so forth. And in fact, it's both. There's a lot of stuff that goes on the ground, I'm sure, that some jerk in the RT studio or in the Kremlin bureaucracy thinks up, barely tells his boss about, and throws it out there, and it often does not stick. And this gets to another area where I think we need to know a lot more about, which is the political and bureaucratic context in Moscow, how this works. I mean, who pays for RT? You probably saw that Simonyan interview the other last weekend in the FT. What bureaucratic forces are at play? When RT had its budgets cut about a year and a half ago, what was that about? And we have very little understanding of how that works, because when you go behind the bogeyman, ultimately this is politics Putin style, as Mark said, and it's going to play out in the way that it plays out in a less than fully coordinated way.
Right, and also in who pays not just for RT, but all of these operations cost money.
All
of these things cost money. But one of the things, actually, I mean, this is one of the things that really got me thinking as I was kind of preparing for this, is that if you look at a lot of each of these individual cases, and as we discussed this, Mark, in the last week on the podcast, they appear to backfire. You look at the Lisa case, this infamous case in Germany, where basically the Russian media essentially fabricated a story about a Russian-German girl who was allegedly raped by migrants, and the Germans weren't doing anything about it. And this allegedly backfired big time, right? It infuriated Angela Merkel and turned German public opinion against Russia. The DNC hack. If you look at it on the surface, it backfired. Russia's suddenly the front and center in the U.S. elections. Maybe that's what they want to be. I don't know. But in terms of, I mean, you can't use this in any covert way now. But if you look at all of these things cumulatively, this kind of death by a thousand cuts scenario, you have to wonder if all of these things taken together aren't poisoning the atmosphere in the West, aren't contributing to the angst the West is feeling right now, and the crisis of confidence, which all plays into the Kremlin's hands now. So should we be looking at this more broadly and not looking at each individual case? Don, what do you think? You're nodding. What do you think?
I very much agree with that. I think the persistence of fantastic invented narratives in Ukraine, for example, in the West, in people talking about it in the West, shows that it does have a certain direction, whether it's fascists in Kiev or anti-Semitism in Odessa and so forth and so forth. So I think the death by a thousand cuts image is a good one, because ultimately it plays upon the unity of the West, the lack of self-confidence. And that's a key difference, for, I think, from the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Mark, would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the very fact that there is... I mean, we keep using RT, which in some ways gives RT
too much credit.
All the airtime it needs. Yeah, but anyway, you know, I mean, RT and others, you know, they play to so many negative, divisive stereotypes and assumptions. And even if actually their target audience is very, very small, though obviously a lot of it is actually through YouTube rather than direct broadcasting. But nonetheless, you know, it keeps a certain attitude bubbling up. And in this respect, I mean, it's a slightly dangerous parallel to use, but I mean, it's exactly the same way that jihadist propaganda is using, you know, it picks on particular themes, particular issues. And in some ways, it just simply reflects back what people want to hear, what people want to be told about their prejudices. It never challenges, it actually reflects this particular audience. But again, I mean, when it comes down to it, I mean, obviously this helps, we presume, magnify the angst, you put it, the current crisis of legitimacy that is being experienced across the West, and we're seeing played out in our sort of overt politics in all kinds of different ways. But this is in some ways exactly what we've seen also with a lot of domestic parties of the extreme. I mean, in some ways, again, what the Russians are doing is piggybacking on the activities of a lot of distinctly nasty movements, individuals and groups, particularly within Europe, I'm bound to say. Though the Americans, I feel America is coming up strongly to make a challenge. In that respect, I mean, yes, obviously it has an impact. And this is why I think we just simply need to balance that. I would not for a minute say the Russians are not having any kind of impact at all. I'm just worried at the extent that sometimes we concentrate on that rather than actually thinking about what are the underlying issues. And that's where I think we need to sort of make sure that we don't give the Russians too much credit.
Yeah. No, and I wanted to pick up on your comment about RT, because in a lot of ways, RT is a decoy here. I mean, everybody knows what RT is, right? But the more insidious things, and we see them here in the Czech Republic, we have a lot of these little internet media outlets with really like respectable names, right? That are actually Kremlin financed and are seeping this stuff into the information space and creating narratives. It's classic active measures. And I actually experienced the result of this. It was really in a really surprising way. I mean, I was going on Czech television. It was on the anniversary of MH17 last year. And the first question they asked me, my jaw dropped, was, now, Brian, it's been a year, and do you think we'll ever really know who did this? And my jaw dropped because I couldn't believe they were that I was actually being asked, and we were live. I had to keep my composure, right? So I was like, well, as a matter of fact, yes, we do know. And the fact that you're asking me this question live on the air shows me how well this policy the Kremlin's pursuing is working in this country, where people should be extremely suspicious of Moscow. I get a question like that on state television. But Don, you wanted to jump in. I interrupted you.
On that point, Brian, I very much agree with you. And you will see, for example, a story from a Russian domestic broadcaster picked up by a very small website, for example, in Tallinn, maybe visited by 100 people a month. But that story then radiates out horizontally to affect the conversation in the country, just as you mentioned. And at some point, you forget where it came from because it becomes part of the standard rhetoric. The other point I wanted to make was going back to Mark's earlier point about the West, which is to say a lot of Western leaders manipulate narratives in an unfortunate way as well. I could speak of our own government's unwillingness to call ISIS ISIS or spin facts, and it's not unique to this government, spin facts in a way that focuses on sort of a postmodern narrative rather than the facts. And that encourages, that gives openings, or it creates skepticism among the listeners, whether they're listening to their own leaders or the Kremlin, and that makes it a much more fertile field for the Kremlin to exploit because people are skeptical already about what their leaders say.
Well, is this,
I made that point earlier.
You raise a good point that the active measures aren't unique to Russia, but what we're seeing is in the West merely just spin. Are we looking at a difference in degree or a difference in kind here? Because I personally think we're looking at a difference in kind.
Oh, I would agree it's a difference in kind. But my point is really that the cynicism, and I'm not implying any moral equivalence, the cynicism that people have about their own leaders in London or in Berlin or here is something that affects the way they look at the world. And that cynicism is something the Kremlin can exploit to a qualitatively different degree.
Mark, you were writing. I believe I saw you writing. Did you want to
yeah, say something? I very much agree. I think this is, for me, the big qualitative difference. On the whole, in the West, spin is about persuading you of something specific, whereas the Russian active measures are not, on the whole, geared towards making people think, gosh, the Russians, they're fine people, and we need to sort of emulate their model or join their alliance or whatever. Instead, it's usually actually about magnifying the cynicism. About, and this goes back to your example of Czech TV, of creating a world in which nothing is known, nothing is real, everything is lies, everyone's a hypocrite, just some people are better at it than others. And it's creating this almost this anomy, this sense that there are no values, that there is no truth. That is what is actually, I think, fundamental to the Russian active measures operation. And again, it's about destruction. It is about disintegrating ties that bind rather than trying to create different ties.
Now, I would have the logical question to follow up on is that the fact that these things are thriving right now in this crisis of confidence that the West is experiencing, and let's face it, we've all seen this movie before. We remember the 70s. They looked a lot like this, right? With the trouble in the transatlantic relationship, angst on both sides of the Atlantic, and that passed. And I'm pretty confident that this too will pass. And you have to wonder, is this just a moment for Russian active measures, and they will cease to even be a factor once this passes? Don, what do you think? You've seen this movie before.
It's very comparable to the 70s in some ways. I think there are differences in a couple of ways. First is that we don't have the filter of ABC News or BBC every night anymore. People can get on the computer and talk to whomever they want. And that makes the disease, I think, much more inbaked into the Western way of looking at things. And that's going to be harder to overcome, although I think it, to some extent will pass. The other difference, I think, primarily is that in the 80s, both sides in people's minds at least represented, I won't say an ideology, although it was that, a set of values and perceptions, which I think is going to be hard to return to. Now, Mark's quite right that Russia in many ways represents chaos and cynicism and aggressive manipulation of the external environment and at home. But the West now has this problem too, and I think it will pass much less quickly than it will than it did in the 70s and 80s, Brian. I hate to say that, mm-hmm. but it's a much more difficult thing.
No, this is a meme I continuously return to because I do think this is the case. Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure how well I remember the 70s. Nice. But yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you're the youngster on this one, I forget. You're a whole year younger than me.
Exactly, and how often can I say that? The information sphere absolutely has changed. Don, I agree with him absolutely that we're never going to have, well, I say we're never going to have, unless and until we decide that censorship and state control is the way forward, which I hope we never will. We're never going to have that kind of ability to control or just have controllable people's access to information. And likewise, obviously, that the whole ideological sort of environment has changed. But I do think in some ways this is a moment in two separate ways. One is that this is very, very much, I think, associated with Putinism and Putin's reign. I don't think it's something that we should necessarily assume will outlive him, because, you know, we actually have with Putin a Russian leader who, precisely because his vision for the country is diametrically opposed to, you know, the fundamentals of the international system. He therefore has to erode, decay, weaken, and distract that in international system. I mean, the effect is the same. I mean, Don talks about it, sort of attempts to expand influence abroad. I think of this much more as kind of offensive defensiveness. He wants to make sure the world can't actually stop him doing what he wants at home. It doesn't really matter why. I mean, the impact is the same. But I said, so this is Putin has, in this respect, declared war on the international system. I don't think it's necessarily the case that any successor will. So that's one moment number one. But moment number two is more generally, yeah, as we enter a world of, I wouldn't necessarily say democratic, but wholly pluralistic and uncontrolled access to information. My big concern is that where Russia leads, everyone will follow. That even, let's say, Putin goes and a new Russian leadership, even if it's not a nicer Russian leadership, is a more sensible one and doesn't want to continue this challenge. Mm-hmm. Well, who knows who will be next to actually use the same instruments that Russia is using not terribly well, and work out ways of using them even better in the future.
Or the converse. I mean, like Don pointed out at the very outset, these things that you both pointed out, these things have been around since Tsarist times. And as we're going to talk about pretty soon, they were a staple of Soviet policy, but they just weren't as effective as they seem to be. I don't think they were as effective as they seem to be now. And you point out a couple of reasons for that. I mean, I think the key reason for that is this crisis of confidence we're seeing in the West. I think that's the main independent variable explaining this phenomenon right now. I expect the Russians to keep using this, because when they're not using them, that's been the exception, not the rule. When did they not use them? It was during the Gorbachev and Yeltsin times. And those were the exception, not the rule in Russian history, right? Or no?
Well, yeah, but again, yeah. I wouldn't necessarily assume that just because you can draw a line back, you know, it's a little bit like saying in 1946, well, Germans are always going to be our enemies. Actually, you know, there always comes a point when things change. And I think actually we can see positive signs in Russia. Again, I mean, in this respect, I know I'm very, very unfashionably optimistic. You know, there's not going to be any positive change under Putin, but I think we can see the signs for optimism elsewhere. But that's a matter for another podcast.
And God, and you're stealing my mantle, Mark. A copyright may be violated here. I used to have the role of the optimist in this podcast, but I haven't for a long time, unfortunately. And I think that actually says a lot. Don, did you want to jump in here?
No, I would agree. I will cede to Mark the optimistic mantle for the morning. Whoever comes next, it could be let's call it some kind of business military oligarchy or whatever, I think is likely to use many of the same tools as Putin does, if not as aggressively, and if in a different mix. And I don't want to jump to the next part of the program, Brian, but Mark, in passing, made a reference to Russia at home, and in many ways that is the elephant in the room in terms of a strategy, an information strategy from the Kremlin. It's clearly designed to maintain power. And you've seen passing fancies like political mobilization and other things come and go, and it was never clear to me what real political mobilization is, other than people watching the evening news from Ukraine in front of their sofa. I think Strelkov said that. Right. And this is a continuing challenge for Russia at home, which is to say, what instruments can we use to keep power? Mm-hmm. I think that's really something that they're starting to grapple with now, as some of the enthusiasm, a lot of the enthusiasm about Ukraine and Crimea has died down.
Now, I put a blog out this week where I kind of was looking at, like, what could possibly be some of the motivations for, I called it a troll with a cause, basically saying what could possibly be some of the motivations for what we're seeing now with this. And I came up with two, and one of them, it's come up in this podcast before. Mark, you've said it. Vladimir Frolov said it on this podcast. Basically, Putin's doing what he thinks we're doing. Right. He thinks we're trying to manipulate his elections. He thinks we're trying to encourage separatism in Russia and so on. So he just feels compelled to do the same thing. I think it's significant to note that this month a Congress of separatists will gather in Moscow, featuring all sorts of separatists from everywhere, from Spain to Northern Ireland to Texas and California. But this is an active measure. This is an active measure. It's not nearly as effective as the DNC hack, but he thinks we're doing that. That's number one. Number two, it's kind of this that Putin wants. He doesn't want a new Cold War. He wants a movie about a new Cold War, as Peter Pomerantsev might put it. And he's getting one. As a result of the DNC hack, for the first time since the Cold War, Russia is front and center in a U.S. presidential election. So there are some kind of concrete goals here. And I was wondering what both of you thought of that, those arguments. Mark, you're looking skeptical.
Well, I mean, I think, look, I mean, in terms of Putin doing what he thinks that we're doing to him, yeah, absolutely agreed. I think in terms of the movie of the Cold War, in some ways, I don't know if he cares what is being discussed on American TV news, unless and until it starts to feed into policy. I think that the movie of the Cold War is a domestic one. And again, this speaks to the issue that Don was making. I mean, that's where he needs the movie. That's where he needs to say, look, you know, basically to ordinary Russians, particularly Russians who are suffering, not only are you actually suffering because of the West, but ultimately you have to put up with me because basically I am the person who will defend you from that nasty West. That sounds nice, but, and again, this feeds into the whole rest of the active measures, but as we've seen, they may sound like they're Democrats and, you know, lovely, fuzzy people, individual, but in fact, they're actually beneath the surface, ruthless hypocrites geared at despoiling the planet and making money and doing whatever else that they want to do. I mean, so again, this is where the feedback process, and ironically, the fact that Russia is so connected into the global information sphere. On the one hand, it's a vulnerability for the Kremlin, because in theory, you know, people can therefore decide, oh, well, let's go and see what's on the RFERL website or BBC or whatever. But it also actually means that you get a sort of a deliberate flowing back. You see, even Western media sources, and again, at which point they'll cite this ludicrous little thing in Estonia that has 100 readers, whatever. But even Western sources say that, in fact, NATO is preparing troops for invasion of St. Petersburg or whatever lunacy of the moment may be. So I think that's where the real movie is.
Mm. Don, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I think one of the dangers is that a lot of people in the West, or more than you'd hope, seem to believe the Kremlin movie. And that's very worrying, and it shows a shortcoming of Western policy in a lot of ways. And I mentioned Ukraine earlier, but you can pick a lot of examples. All you need to do is pick up the Johnson Russia list every day and see what's on that. So right. That's what's troubling, that so many people take Ukraine with clear facts on the ground about these MH17 or whatever, still believe the Kremlin movie. And that's something that's very hard to combat and very hard to deal with. And I think it comes from a dissatisfaction about Western citizens about their own governments, even though they're not really related in most ways.
Right. And that's something that I think will pass. All right. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the lessons the Soviet Union's Cold War active measures hold for the current day. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Американцы ведут в Корее бактериологическую войну.
Приземлялся ли на самом деле Аполлон на Луну?
Не было такого полета.
Это была художественная постановка.
В Джонстауне произошло одно из самых страшных масс.
Дело рук агентов ЦРУ, поскольку коммуна имела связи с...
Это совсем не эпидемия смертельного вируса.
Иоанн Павел II, возможно, самый популярный папа римский...
The United States used biological weapons in the Korean War. The moon landing was a hoax. AIDS was an invention of the CIA, the Jonestown Massacre was carried out by U.S. intelligence, and the United States tried to kill Pope John Paul II. These were just some of the false narratives planted by the KGB in the Cold War era as part of Soviet active measures campaigns. The KGB and the GRU, moreover, spent billions of dollars supporting front organizations and attempting to foment dissent and unrest in the West. And in the end, it all came to nothing. We know how the movie ended. Don, how instructive is this for our time? Or has the game changed decisively due to the advent of the internet, social media, globalization, and all the things that you mentioned earlier that are making our world smaller? We've seen this movie before, but yet this is a totally new version of this movie. So does the past instruct us at all here?
This is a question that comes up all the time, Brian, when in policy circles, when the people say, well, it will pass just like the Cold War. And so let me illustrate some differences, because I do think it's to some extent quite different. One, as I said earlier, would be the ideological issue. Neither side seems firmly committed to a set of a way of looking at the world, a set of values, and certainly the Russians are not, compared to the Cold War. So everything, truth, untruth, is very much in flux, and that, I think, is a big difference and makes the Kremlin's job easier. Second, we mentioned the proliferation of news sources, information sources, and that also makes the Kremlin's job easier, as I said. But the third major difference is that Russia is, no matter what it might say, much more integrated into the world economy and into the especially economically, than was the Soviet Union and in the Cold War. And so this decisively, I think, affects how they view the international order they talk about overthrowing at the same time as they benefit from. And I think that's a major difference. And it affects, I think, the strategies they pick when they're trying to get their message out, whatever it might be. Because there is to some extent, and I reserve judgment about Putin, to some extent, with some of the people around Putin, a natural limit to how long this can go on. I think that may be a strain we see inside the Kremlin.
Now, I was writing each of those three things down, Don, and I want to address them each individually. I mean, in terms of the ideology, you're right. But as James Scherer has pointed out in this program, we don't have a Cold War. We don't have two ideologies. We do have two distinct normative systems. As James put it, in the West, we have one that's based on the rule of law, the sanctity of contracts, individual rights, and so on. And one to the East, we have one that's based on patron-client relationships, the cronyism, the subordination of the law to power, and so on. So there are two normative systems that are competing. They're not so clear, as clear-cut as the ideological battles of the Cold War, but they're there. On the information sources, I agree with you, but, and this is, I can't get my head around what I think about this. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, because while these new information sources give the Kremlin new opportunities to use active measures more opportunities than they had in the Cold War era, there's also more opportunities to push back. And so in that sense, that's a double-edged sword. And I would say ditto for the Russian integration into the global economy. They're more integrated And therefore, they're much more vulnerable to things like very targeted sanctions, as we're seeing now. So they're dependent on the global economy. And if the West ever decided to isolate them from it, that would take an enormous act of political will. Their economy would crumble like a house of cards. So I'm thinking these things are all kind of double-edged, no?
You're absolutely right. They're all double-edged. And who am I to disagree with my good friend James? I would argue that, because I largely agree with you in terms of emphasis, I would argue that the distinction between the values in the West, which I think James is right about, and the ability of governments to live up to those values is wider than in the past, or in any case, more publicized. And that, mm-hmm. that gives
I would say the latter.
What's that?
I would say the latter.
Yes. Yes. And that gives, and that's a reflection, as you said, of the broader array of information sources. And that gives the other side an opportunity for exploitation that, to nuance it, may have been there in the Cold War, but was not as obvious.
Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think one of the key differences that I would say, again, I think as soon as we draw a comparison with Soviet times, is the sort of, again, this business of positive versus negative examples and the extent to which at the moment, for most people, actually, Russia really has nothing active and positive to offer. I mean, you see, if I think back to when I think that Soviet active measures were at their most effective, vastly more effective than they are now, it will be with Comintern in the 1920s, in which you have in the West, you have the era of the Great Depression, the rise of fascism and so forth. And there was still this genuine belief that the Soviet model actually offered something. And then also the period, particularly in the 1960s, of national liberation struggles, in which the Soviets could position themselves as the great allies in the fight against colonialism in Africa, Asia and Latin America. Now, in both those cases, largely mythologically, but nonetheless, it seemed to be that the Soviets actually had something positive to offer, both an ideology, but also a model for development, a model for how a society and an economy and so forth could be structured and indeed developed. Nowadays, though, and again, in part because the Soviet Union sort of has gone and taken with it any real sort of ideological underpinnings. What does Putin stand for? There is no real ideology except nationalism and autocracy there. But also, precisely, we have so many more ways of knowing in just such a miserable state Russia is in. This is not so much a case of, perhaps once upon a time, to use that sort of charming expression, the Soviets could put lipstick on a pig. But really what they're actually doing was just simply telling a great tale about a pig that was just out of sight. But trust me, it was a really wonderful pig. Well, if I can follow this now, I'm increasingly wishing I hadn't.
I'm really glad you did. Come on, keep going, Mark.
We're in an age in which, firstly, everyone can see the pig if they want to. And secondly, it's not a very appealing sight. So in that era, I mean, in a way, I think why active measures and propaganda at certain points was so much more effective for the Soviets is precisely because it seemed to be that they had something to offer. Now, precisely, the Russians don't. And this is why I think the Russian model is so negative. It's not about we're great. It's about you're not as good as you think you are. And this is where precisely they can take full advantage of the fact that we now know that much more about the gap between our soaring expectations of what we believe our governments and systems ought to offer and what they actually do.
And isn't this how it all worked in the Cold War? Because at the end of the day, they didn't have an appealing model to offer, which they themselves acknowledged in the Perestroika era. And so, again, we're going to this movie may be a little different. It may have a lot more bells and whistles this time and a lot cooler gadgets. But at the end of the day, the movie's going to end just like it ended in the 80s and 90s.
Except, again, but the script of the movie was different. And dear God, now you got me using your metaphor.
let's make a movie about a pig.
The Soviet sort of era one was actually the Soviets genuinely did want to try and expand their ideology. They genuinely wanted to convince people. And they did so, like any good sort of cult or pyramid scheme, by basically sort of selling a mythologically wonderful image of a fairly miserable reality. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that there was both a real ideology there, which one which, let's face it, the Soviets never lived up to, and also a whole kind of mythic image of that. Putin today, he has no real ideology. Yeah, there's things that they can tweak and try and little sort of micro scales and so forth. Basically speaking, there is nothing really there. And likewise, it's that much harder for him to even try and sell something, because exactly as you've made it clear, the extent to which actually, you know, information does flow both ways. So the tactics may well be very similar in some ways, but I think actually both the way in which it's worked and the likely outcomes are going to be different. Putin does not win by convincing us to become Putinists. Putin wins by making us that much more miserable, divided, and unhappy and unsettled about who we really are ourselves.
Don, would you agree with that?
I would. I can't resist one of my favorite Cold War anecdotes, and it's only 15 seconds, which is that a friend of mine raised a communist in Bulgaria, used to go to the embassy movies every week, and he realized it was a lost ideology. When he watched the movies, they opened the refrigerator, and it was not that the food was everywhere and it was full, it was that nobody commented about it. And so these kind of basic bread and butter concerns, I think, matter a great deal, but I agree on the decline of ideology. I would caution my friends, though, that in terms of looking at this question, we should be careful about kind of over cosmic views, world views of what's going on. When the information or other Soviet levers of influence, Russian levers of influence are used with a very specific purpose in mind, let's say stirring up unrest in Narva, or let's say in taking Crimea, or there are a number of other very specific uses of this stuff, which is far, far more micro than what we've been talking about, then I think it is something that we ought to be concerned about. And that's, I think, that nuanced view of its impact, getting back to what we talked about at the beginning, that's something we need to pay a lot more attention to.
Well, that kind of brings us around to where I wanted to end up, and that's with the SEPA recommendations that were in that excellent report by Edward Lucas and Peter Pomerantsev that came out this week. Don, I know you were involved with this. I mean, what jumped out at you from those recommendations in terms of combating this? Because they do address it both at the micro and the macro level. Did anything jump out at you in particular about those recommendations?
Well, I hate to mindlessly support my friends Peter and Ed, because it's not mindless.
I will mindlessly and shamelessly support my friends Peter and Edward.
One of the first times, Mark and Brian, one of the first times I've seen substantive, detailed policy recommendations about how to respond. And this report, I think, thankfully gets into real nuts and bolts of what kind of response is appropriate. And I don't think I've seen that anywhere before at this level of detail.
Uh-huh. Mark, did you get a chance to take a look at this and
yeah.
jump out at you?
Well, look, I mean, obviously I have to put in a slightly sort of counter-argument, otherwise where will be the interest in the conversation? Now, I mean, I would start actually with absolutely endorsing the final strategic recommendations that were made. That the key points are essentially addressing legitimacy within the Western system, but also, shall we say, the media literacy of Western populations. That's something that has been woefully neglected. I'm a little more concerned about some of the sort of tactical and specific ones, which were, you know, our ideas have been thrown around, and I definitely would encourage the readers to read it, because actually it's a very, very thoughtful and intelligent study. But when we start moving into things like myth-busting, in other words, taking on the particular sort of lies and spins that we get, let alone actually sort of almost sort of creating our own propaganda, which of course we always call things like kind of strategic messaging. There, I'm worried that we're actually going to try and essentially take on the Russians on their own turf. Myth busting, for example, often just simply takes a lie and brings it to a different audience. If people are anyway willing to assume that their own governments lie to them, the government saying, no, these foreigners are not telling you the truth, is unlikely to change their opinion. And I think the danger is we actually then build this into something that is much more sort of effective. So I would say, ironically, the various tactical suggestions make sense, but only if you address the big strategic one. And why I think that's the concern is I suspect that governments are going to latch onto the tactical ones, which seem to kind of promise quick metrics, quick results, relatively cheap, without addressing the big strategic issues. So I think it actually has to be dealt with as one combined approach.
I mean, one of the tactical recommendations that I found very intriguing was the kind of the creation of a almost like a Transparency International NGO, which isn't something governments would do. This would have to be taken up by civil societies to keep the information sphere clean of corruption, as you, if you will. I thought that was one of the more interesting tactical. I would agree wholeheartedly on the strategic recommendations. I think that to not address those and to do the others is certainly like putting the cart before the horse. But I would strongly recommend that everybody take a good look at this, because it is the most comprehensive study of this with the most comprehensive recommendations that I've seen to date. In fact, I was thinking when I was writing about this on my newsletter this week, I said, you know, is there really room for yet another report on the information war? And after reading this, the answer is an emphatic yes. All right. On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRO. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Washington, D.C. has been veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
It's been a
pleasure here, too. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.